Well, it is great to be together to consider this topic, and we're dealing with the question of satisfaction. Where's it found? What's the key to life? What about life will make it most satisfying, and so on? It's a powerfully important question. And kind of to put it another way, let me put it this way. What will make it that your life was worth living? That's kind of to cast it just in another slightly different direction. What will it be that you can say at the end, that was a life worth having lived? Just get this. We only have one shot at it. All of us only have one chance. 170, 80, 90 years, let's say. And what will make it such that at the end of that, you'll be able to say it was worth it? Just cast yourself forward, in fact. Do this kind of thought experiment with me if you can pull this off. Cast yourself forward to the, 70, 80, 90, and you are on your deathbed. And you know that you've only got a day, 2 days, hours to live. And you are, your mind is still sharp. You're able to reflect back on life. Just cut. Now, some of you are right there already, I know that. But others of you, it'll take a fair bit more imagination to pull that one off. But put yourself into that context there. That wasn't rude, that was just true. But put yourself there and reflect back. What would have to have happened through those years for you to feel like life was worth living? It was a life that was satisfying. Now, just imagine yourself there and think with this with me. Imagine thinking back on your life and going, I'm dissatisfied. I'm not happy with how it went. I'm not happy with the way I lived. I'm not happy with family, friends, relationships. I don't feel content and satisfied. Can you imagine the tragedy of that? Can you imagine how horrific that would be? The only life you had to live, and your reflection back on it is that it isn't all that it was meant to be? You know, I think that's such a devastating possibility that almost no one reflects on it. I think most people in that context simply won't let themselves reflect honestly, because it is so devastating. One of the ways you can actually destroy a person's life before you take their life is to take everything from them. This is the way despots and cruel rulers and so on in the past would bring revenge on someone. They'd slaughter their kids in front of them. They'd take everything they've worked for and remove it all entirely so that as they, before they died, they'd know it was all gone. But can you imagine that? Now, how do you make sure that doesn't happen for you, that you get to the end of your days and don't find yourself honestly reflecting, saying, I blew it? How do you make sure you get there? Is there an answer to life that makes it worth living? What will make it satisfying? You know, that's a question that we put to the community some months back, and these last 3 weeks have been in response to that. The answers that we got back, we've turned into these topics that we're considering. They've sort of shaped what we've been doing. And today, many people responded that for them, the key to satisfaction, the thing that would make their life a satisfied life, is living with simple pleasures. Living with simple pleasures. If they just live their life enjoying simple pleasures, it would have been a satisfying life. Now, actually, just as I say that, I hope, having given the introduction like that, the monumental character of life, the weight of all that life is, actually, do you have a little bit of an inkling that to set at the end of it and say, I live for simple pleasures, does that really make life worth living? If that's what I learned to love black tea was such a great life. You know, is that what it, I mean, just right there is just an alert to us that there's something of an issue here to consider. And I want to explore it with you. I want to wrestle with this question in 4 points, similar to what we've done in previous weeks. The first point I want to deal with is that there is something admirable about pursuing simple pleasures. I do want to say there is something good there, and for a number of reasons. If you want to make sure that you do pull off a life that has been satisfying, and you want to make sure you do hit the target of being satisfied, far better to aim low than high. Isn't that right? Far better to aim for simple pleasures than complex, rich, extravagant ones, because you're more likely to pull off the simple one. Okay, so there's just something admirable and good about that. The fact that you're living on the Central Coast already tells me you've decided which one you're after. Isn't that right? If you're actually after the more rich, complex, massive, life goals about being satisfied in rich things, you wouldn't be here. You'd move to the big city. You'd go to New York. You'd make your $1 million, or you'd marry well and make sure they had the holiday house here on the Central Coast. But the fact that I'm talking to you by definition means that you've already made a decision that you're actually going to pursue the simple pleasures. Am I right in this? Or you've been born to it and you can't actually get out and you're stuck and your only option is to move further north. But it is far smarter to learn to live with simple things and find satisfaction in them because you can afford it. Far better to learn to love sliding down the Wombe sand dunes on a second-hand boogie board than only being able to find satisfaction in heli skiing in Japan. I mean, one's just much easier to pull off and you'll actually enjoy it and you can get there. Far better to love the simple pleasure you get from a home-cooked meal than needing to do five-star restaurants all the time. It's just you can achieve that one. It's a far better thing to be able to pull off. You remember at Christmas time, you may have experienced this, the child who gets the Christmas presents, the parents have spent thousands of dollars on a play centre with bells and whistles and lights that flash and it talks and it walks, and they give it to the child and the child unwraps it all, and what do they end up playing with half an hour later? Yeah, the box. And wouldn't you love it if that's all they ever needed to play with? Because you could give that every year, a box. I just think it's a little parable of life, isn't it? If we can just keep with simple, it's so much easier to pull off. Practically, it's better to aim low because you can make it happen. But there's also something more wholesome about it. There is something healthier about learning to be satisfied with simple pleasures. Let me explain what I mean. There's something better about learning to be satisfied with just the act of growing your own food in the backyard and the pleasure and joy that brings than needing to be satisfied through online shopping constantly. There's something more wholesome and good for you that you find satisfaction in that kind of simple pleasure than the other. Am I right? You know, it's been in the past, we've had someone disagreed just there, I heard. Well, let me say to you, Sue, not all pleasures are equal. It's a truth. We've kind of gone through this period where we've not wanted to judge anyone, and so we've been able to say, whatever makes you happy, whatever you find satisfying, go and pursue it. But it's not helpful, because some things that you find satisfying that have been cultivated in you will pull you down, will create enslavement, will actually impoverish you and destroy you, whereas other pleasures actually make you bigger and better. Not all pleasures are the same. It is better to actually make judgments about what are best kinds of pleasures and learn to actually enjoy them. So there is something admirable and good about finding satisfaction in simple things. And I want to offer that the scriptures were way ahead of us on this. We've been looking at this book Ecclesiastes in past weeks, and we'll touch on it again today. And one of the things the book of Ecclesiastes says is that whatever your hand finds you to do, do it with all your heart. That wife that you love, enjoy life with them. Simple things are beautiful and good. You know, the scriptures, the Bible was there long before we ever worked it out. But, now there is a but. Yes, simple pleasures are good, can be very good, but there is a but, there is a problem. Now, I know some of you are thinking, how can they even be down on simple pleasures? Can't they let anything through? What is it with these guys? Well, get hold of the nuance. There is something good about simple pleasures. There's something wholesome. God has given us all good things to enjoy. It's okay to enjoy. But it is important to reflect and consider whether there are dangers in this path. And I want to offer this morning that there are three, possibly more, but I'm going to draw attention to three. Now, the first one that I'm going to draw attention to is not the big one. And I may not actually be able to convince all of us of it. And that's okay. You might differ with me on the first one. The second and third one, are the big ones. And I want to persuade you of those. But let me take you through the first one because I think it is important to get our heads around. The first point is this, that making the key to your satisfaction simple pleasures does something to the orientation of your life that is potentially problematic. And when I'm talking about this, I'm not just talking about pleasure, I'm talking about simple pleasure. Over the last 20, 15 years or so, last bunch of time, there's been quite a shift to not just enjoy pleasures, but actually to have a desire now to pursue simple pleasures. It's been a bit of a movement that we've seen in society over the last little while. And what I mean by simple there is not just modest and inexpensive, but what I mean by simple, what I think is happening in recent times is people are thinking about pleasure, simple pleasure, when they mean retreating, escaping, and dropping out. There is a mood in society where we are seeking to find satisfaction in simple pleasures, where we retreat from the developed world back to the world of our great-great-grandparents and the simplicity that they had. Or we escape the city and the complex and the crowded and the costly to the simple. And there's a movement to find the satisfaction in those simple things as an escape, a retreat, as a dropping out. People aren't just wanting to consume less, which is a good thing. They're wanting to throw off development and the development of the developed world, which brings all its complexity, and get back to simple. Now, there is a longing here that I want to kind of touch in a moment, but this movement, this desire to find satisfaction in simple, where simple is a retreat and a dropout, it's a remove from complexity, from development, it brings within it, or can be driven by, a very serious danger. A deadly orientation of life. Now, my hope is to intrigue you to think with me about this. And the way I want to do this is by looking at a passage that we had read from Philippians chapter 2. There's the two passages read for us. I want to consider both of them this morning, but I want to start with Philippians chapter 2. If you do have a Bible, then it is helpful to flip to it. If not, listen in, though I think it's in your handout as well. So you've got that slip of paper that'll have this text written on it. This is an astonishing bit of the Bible. And the way I think to make sense of the problem, the danger of this simple life as an orientation, is to consider Philippians chapter 2 and what it says about God. Let me take you through this. Philippians chapter 2 verse 6 is a discussion, is a reflection on the person of Jesus. You'll see his name is mentioned in verse 5 there. Verse 6, Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Now, that is an astonishing statement. Jesus is in very nature God. This is just an aside, but it's worth... that man who walked the streets of Palestine, the Bible says, was no ordinary man. He was God in the flesh. That is an astonishing thing to say, which they were convinced of was true, and the evidence was there. But what Paul is saying here is that that man, though in eternity he was in very nature God, he did not cling to that. He didn't grasp after that, some of your translations have got. He didn't need it for his own advantage. He was willing to let go the advantages of being in very nature God for the sake of serving. Look at verse 7. Rather, instead of clinging to the advantage, the prestige, the status, the power, instead of clinging to those things, he made himself nothing, or emptied himself is another way of expressing the same word there. He made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant. The God who should be forever praised and served is so humble, says the Bible, and it's an astonishing thing further, that the God of the universe, says the Bible, is not a preening celebrity who will not be demeaned by stepping into things. That's not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible is a humble God who is committed to serving, becoming a servant, to give to others. And being made in human likeness, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Now, there's so much there that we haven't got time to come into, but he's obedient to death, obedient to his Father, to death on a cross, the very act of which was the means by which he served. Because his death on a cross pays a debt that we owe God, and he pays it for us in our place, that it might be possible for us to be forgiven and restored back to God. That's what's behind all of these words. But the point that Paul makes is a much more simple one, is to say, there's the heart of God. There's the very essence of who God is. He is the kind of God that loves. Where love doesn't just mean feeling romantically towards someone strongly. Where love actually means strictly serve, give, sacrifice, look to the other. And that is this God, the God of the Bible. He is celebrated as the one who is love. One of his greatest attributes, alongside of his holiness, is his orientation towards serving and love. He made us out of love, and he comes to seek us out of love. He's a God who gives. Now, the writer applies this to humans and the way we should operate. Look in chapter 2, verse 5. In your relationship with one another, have the same mindset. What's the same mindset? Verse 4. Not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. The piece the writer pulls out from the extraordinary truth that God descends, becomes man, serves, gives himself up, the extraordinary truth he draws from that is that God is a God who gives, we ought to be as well. We ought to have that same attitude that says, my life is about serving, loving, giving. God made us for that glorious thing. And he calls on us to be like that. It's why, verse 9, this Jesus is exalted to the highest place, because he's that kind of person. Now, when you get all of that context and perspective, think with me about making simple pleasures the key to your satisfaction. Where simple pleasure means retreating, escaping, dropping out to enjoy simple pleasures. What's the orientation of that life? It's self. It's turned in on itself. It's turned in on me and mine. It's making the driving force of my life what will make me happy. It's to put us completely at odds with the God who is love. It's to be in a very different frame of mind and heart than the God who gives and serves. To work towards getting out of society, to be on my own, to work towards getting the small plot to be self-sufficient sounds admirable. I'm no longer the consumer. But the danger is I'm no longer being a contributor. Imagine if everyone embraced this notion. Imagine if we all dropped out and retreated into our plot, gave up working for the community and society. We'd go backwards as a society. Now, some people say that's a good thing, to go back to our great-great-grandparents. All the development has just brought complexity and pain and grief. If we can just go back to the simple things, we'd be far better. If we can just go back to the Pacific Island, where they're much more simple, we'd be better off. Friends, think with me. Just take one island, which I'm somewhat familiar with, and some of you are as well. So this may help us. Many of us have travelled there. Some of you go holidaying there. And so Vanuatu. Vanuatu is a beautiful place. And the oft-repeated reflection is that people are so happy. And if only we could make life more simple, back to the village, back to the self-sufficient. But did you know that the life expectancy of an adult in Vanuatu is 10 years less than ours? And that's only after a great deal of work on health outcomes through aid and development. The infant mortality rate is 7 times higher than that in Australia. 21 infants die per 1,000 adults in Vanuatu versus 2.9 in Australia. Which would you rather have? The health outcomes we enjoy, the life that we enjoy, comes through development. If you'd committed to that world and raised your family there, you would actually commit them to a greater level of poverty in real terms. Vanuatu only manages and grows and develops because they receive $150 million in aid a year from developed countries. Australia gives $63 million of aid a year to Vanuatu, which is what we ought to do. Praise God we do it. We ought to do more. But we're only able to do it because we've worked and developed and expanded our society so that it actually has the capacity to give to others in need. There is much that is wrong with Western civilization, much that we need to fix. But it has given us a health care that no other society has enjoyed. It's given us medicine and technology that helps and serves and reduces poverty and does extraordinary things. It's complex, though. Australia Day. I don't know if you picked up the debates around Australia Day, that we should no longer celebrate Australia Day because it's an invasion day and it's a great tragedy. Now, here's the thing. It was an invasion day. It was the invasion of Europeans into the first inhabitants of this country. And it devastated their culture. If you're unaware of what you ought to read into this and see what Europeans did as they arrived here. It was dreadful. The abuses we foisted, the carnage, the sickness, the devastation. We have got a lot to apologise for. But Western civilization has brought much that's good and much that's bad. But it's raised all kinds of health outcomes. It's done extraordinary good. It's made it possible to actually give. And so it's said, no, the Australian first Indigenous population was an Eden garden. And there's a recent historian that's reflected on this and made much of the fact that it was actually quite an extraordinary democracy and developed, and it was a beautiful Eden context. The history doesn't match. The facts are it was a struggling community. European society has brought much that's good and much that's bad. You see, here it is. If you pursue the dropout from the evils of society into the simple retreat back to the, you will lose a great deal. It's a turn inwards. It will actually impoverish us. But the answer is not simply to stay and amass and grow and get fat. That's not the answer either. The point here is that humans have an extraordinary ability for whatever we pursue to bring a selfish orientation to every dimension of it. To drop out for ourselves, to stay for ourselves. There is something dreadfully wrong with humankind. You know, there is a great danger with thinking the key to the satisfying life is a simpler life. It will turn you inward. The real danger with this as an answer is it's very destructive. Now, as I say, I may not have convinced you all, but it is a conversation we need to have, especially at Australia Day, where I think the tone ought to be grief and celebration as we see the great tragedy and the great good. But let me take you to the larger problems, the life and death problems. I may not have persuaded you of that, but we'll come back to it in a second. The two next ones I want to draw your attention to are the big ones. And they build on each other. Let me give you the first one. When the key to life satisfaction becomes the simple pleasures of life, we are in danger of selling ourselves short. Yes, set the low bar, it's easy to attain. But if you set the low bar, you have cut yourself off from the possibility there is far, far more to be had. And it's possible in that activity of beginning just to enjoy the simple things that you squash an instinct within the human heart that was put there by God. Ecclesiastes 3, he put eternity into our hearts to stir us to see bigger things. I was talking to a man some years ago now, a very fine man, a man I think a great deal of, married to a lovely, wonderful wife, three kids, adopted one because they're trying to actually serve the community they're in and so on. And I was talking to him and at one point I said to him, how's your marriage going? And he said this, I'll read it. I wonder sometimes if this is all there is. I wonder sometimes if this is all there is. And what he was observing was, it's good, but I have those moments where I wonder if this is all that is. Is there the possibility of a deeper intimacy, a greater satisfaction, more wonderful joy, a greater thrill. I wonder if there's more to be had than in the simple enjoyment of my life at present. That's the yearning of a heart, isn't it? That's the deep yearning of someone. And I want to say to you this morning, listen to it. God has set eternity in our hearts. He has made us for more than just simple pleasures. And the fact that you do have that hunger is a powerful God-given voice. Let me read this quote to you. It's a longish quote. It comes from a man called C.S. Lewis, a man who's now some years gone, but in last century. The Christian says, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there is such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy that, that does not prove the universe is a fraud. Probably, earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy, but only to arouse and suggest the real thing. Is that not insightful? There is something more, and we sense it. And that hunger, listen to it. Let me take you, though, to the last point, which is the big one. We now go deep. Come with me to that reading that, yes, was introduced as being quite a strange one, as Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And it is. It's intriguing. It's odd. It takes thought. You know, one of the things we're doing through this series is trying to sort of take you into the Bible to actually see what it has to say, just to give you a sense that the Bible is a profound document. It's just astonishing with what it says. It's astonishing with the way it sees the world. It's almost as if God wrote it. Let me show you what it does here. Have a look at chapter 7, verse 1. A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. What? How is the day of death better than the day of birth? Now, perhaps you find yourself thinking, if you're a Christian, you think, oh, he must be anticipating Jesus and life beyond. And No. That's not what he tells you what he means in the next verse. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting. Which again leaves you puzzled. Okay, the day of death's better. Better to go to a house of mourning, a place where there's grief and sadness, than to the party. What is wrong with this guy? Well, look what he says next. For death is the destiny of everyone, and the living should take this to heart. This is not a man who's just morbid. This is someone who is reflecting deeply. And he is saying the house of feasting, the life of constant fun and pleasure, finding satisfaction in small things, won't help you think about life. But the house of grief, the day of death, now that will help you think about life. That'll force you to think about the big questions of life. That is the purpose of a funeral. One of the most important things I'm ever participating in is a funeral. Weddings are just full of expectation and fun. Everyone's just thinking about how good this is. No one's ready to think deep thoughts. But at a funeral, done well, that is a context where we are confronted with realities, where you are forced or should be helped to think about deep things, except in our day and age, we're working at making that not happen. There was an article written in 2017 that appeared in the papers entitled The Rise of the Happy Funeral. The Rise of the Happy Funeral. This author noticed that there are now themed funerals where the guests can come along as their own superhero. to make sure that grief does not dominate the enterprise, that it's actually a thing to think about in joy and fun and so on. The aim is to be positive and happy. Where the most popular song played at funerals is, what do you think it is? I Did It My Way, yes, that's one. Monty Python's Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And you can see it, can't you? Let's not get morbid. Let's think good thoughts. Always look on the bright side. Now, the author responds by saying, this is a problem in part because the happy funeral, in refusing to allow a life's end to impact us in all its darkness, is no longer helping us through the grieving process. But it's also bad because there's a fundamental form of denial going on in society that cannot cry or get upset. We don't want anything to intrude on our life of simple pleasures. We want to make life as fun as possible. And so we have the rise of happy funerals. The very point, says the writer of Ecclesiastes, which is meant to bring you to grief, to reflect on the big things of life, to stop and make you pause, to stop and take stock and ask the bigger questions. What is this life that ends like this? Is this all there is? Really? Is there nothing beyond? They are utterly profound questions. The danger of focusing on simple pleasures is that you drown out the very things that are necessary to help you stop, pause, and reflect and find some answers. I had a friend who used to own a panel van. Do you remember those panel vans? The scourge of every parent whose daughter was dating the boy with the panel van. But we were good mates, so we used to drive lots of places together. But he'd installed, one day I got in the car and he'd installed this super expensive sound system with an equalizer. Do you remember the days of the equalizers? And all the speakers around the back and front and so on. And he'd turn it up really loud. And I said, what's the deal? And he said, if you're going to own a panel van, you've got to have a loud sound system. I said, why? He said, to drown out all the creaks. Because panel vans creak a lot. And so if you're going to live with a panel van, you had to have something to drown out the noise. Simple pleasures? That's life's sound system. We use it to drown out the serious things of life. Because we don't want to think. You know, they did an experiment with 20-year-olds and they put them in a room for half an hour on their own, on a chair, with nothing in the room, and they took their mobile phone away from them. Now, what do you think they did? They got distressed and agitated because to be alone with their thoughts, without distractions, was a painful experience. Now, you who are older, don't laugh, because what would you do if you got 30 minutes without your phone? You'd go to sleep. So, let's not criticise each other here. You know, I got nothing to do. Gone. But the point is this. The writer of Ecclesiastes, it's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting, for death is the destiny of everyone, and the living should take it to heart. You will learn much more at a good funeral than a great party. Frustration is better than laughter. It's better to experience suffering and pain and frustration in life because it will stop and make you think, and thinking's critical. I'll tell you why it's critical. And isn't it odd that a church should be talking about thinking? But that is exactly what the Bible causes us to do. But I'll tell you why it's important to think. Because if there is more to life than these few years, what will happen after we die? What if there is a God and we will stand before him one day in judgment? What if that's true? And what about if the moments of creaking and frustration and pain and then death of our friends actually force us to think about those things? What if there is a life beyond and there is a God and we will one day stand before him? What then will he think of us? when we come before him? Will it go well or badly? I find so many people don't think about those things, but then if they're forced to for a moment, conclude simply that if there is such a God, I'll be okay. I was in the hospital room just this last week with an older person who's dying and had that conversation. And their response was, I'll be okay. I don't want to talk about it. If it's all true, I'll be okay. Why? Because I've been a decent person. Not if the first point I made is true. If the first point I made is true, then what you have is an insight into the very character of God, who is loving and sacrificial and other person-centered by the very being of their nature. God's very nature is to move outwards in love and service such that it even costs him. But the very nature of a human is to retreat within themselves, to either pursue simple pleasures as a way of getting their own satisfaction for themselves and their family, or not retreating but staying and amassing and finding as much in this developed world to get as much satisfaction as they can for them and their life. But it's undeniable when you think about humankind that our basic orientation is the very opposite of God's orientation. How do you think it will go when we stand before that God? These questions are deeply important. They are life and death important. And the Bible poses them for us and answers them in the most serious way. It says there is a life to come. This life isn't it. There is a God who is holy, righteous, and true, and love. But that love of God means that when you compare our life to his, it is dark and sinful and cannot exist with that God. It says there is no hope for a human on their own to stand before him, except that he has come into the world, not clinging to himself, his status and prestige. He has given that up out of great love. He has come into the world and died on a cross that we might be forgiven. These things, the Bible says, are so important that God speaks to us and brings these to our attention and brings things into our life to stir us to stop and think. But if you keep bringing into your life simple pleasures to actually drown all of that out, you will wake up one day without God. You will be lost. And the great tragedy of it. Do you know, some have said, I hear all of that. I just want to enjoy life at the moment, and when I'm older, I'll come back to it. Have a look at Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Look at verse 1. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. When you will age and you'll be too old to enjoy those things you once enjoyed. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. When the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop. When grinders cease because they are few and those who look through the windows grow dim. You cannot see. When the doors of the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades, I can't hear it anymore. When people rise at the sound of the birds, up so early. Why? Because they have to go to the toilet. You just can't sleep in anymore. Your prostate has got you. All their songs grow faint. When people are afraid of heights, the aged, of dangers in the streets, when the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags itself along and desire is no longer stirred, there's a word for men. As you age, you will lose all these things. Then people go home to their eternal home and mourners go about the street. Remember him before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is broken. For dust you are, and to dust you'll return. The living take this to heart. Do not imagine that because that you can live now enjoying as young, and when you get old you'll come back to it. Because here's the thing. If you invest your life in simple pleasures and make that the center of your being and your place of satisfaction, you'll be locked into it. Your heart will actually be trained by that to not listen, to not listen, to not think, so that as you get older, it'll be harder to think, not easier. And you'll just become bitter and calloused. We are not immune to the life we live. We are not untouched by it. When a person consumes triviality, they become hardened to deeper things. When you fill your life with social media and constant interaction, you will become shallow and shallower, unable to think deeply. Brothers and sisters, friends, there is something good about simple pleasures. Much better to enjoy wholesome, simple pleasures than rich, complex ones. But there are dangers. Dangers are that it will drown out the instincts that God has planted in you of dissatisfaction and hunger for more. And it might finally drown out the great disaster that death is, that you won't think, urge you to think. Let me pause there, and we're going to do something a little unusual, somewhat different. We're going to actually pause for some questions. But here, so we want to have a chance to have some interaction. You might have a question. You might be wondering. Others will have it. Ask it in a moment. What I want you to do is talk to the person next to you just for a second. Is there anything here that's triggered you to think? Go for it. Anything here that's triggered you to think? Try and be serious. Okay, that's just to get the conversation happening. So let's see if there are any questions you want to ask. It's a good opportunity. As I say, don't be surprised that your question you might think is a dumb one, but others will be asking it as well. So is there anything you want to ask? And if not, that's okay, but any questions, good opportunity. Yeah. So some people use simple pleasures as a opportunity to thank God. Now, I guess that's what I'm trying to say in the first point, that there's something good about simplifying life, pursuing pleasures that are wholesome and healthy, because God has given us all good things to enjoy.
One moment.
When they're received with thanksgiving. Yeah. So there's something beautiful about that. That's right. The point, though, I'm making is if you let simple pleasures be the key to your satisfaction, the great danger is that you'll use them to drown out the messages that your God intends you to hear, which is that you are made for far more than simple pleasures. And death is the end of all of us. Think on these things, yeah. Yeah, it's helpful. Do you want to ask anything else?
And if somebody, for instance, you know, from the city says, look, I've had enough, I want to pack it up, let's move to the Central Coast. You know, it's too busy here, too congested, too much traffic.
In the city, so come to the Central Coast.
Come to the Central Coast, and or from the Central Coast up further, coughs up or whatever. You know, at what stage...
Plant a church to reach Coffs Harbour, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's it. You know, at what stage do you think, well... Is God using that? Is God saying, look,
very,
I'm
very
going
good,
to
very good.
Move you forward?
Is that Jack?
Yeah.
How excited were you?
Over the moon.
Over the moon. Father of Nathaniel that we just saw in the video. Jack, beautiful. Jack and Diane. Did that make sense then? Yeah. There is nothing wrong with having tastes where... you don't like inner city living. This is not an issue about it's wrong to move out of the city. This is an issue about why you're moving and what you'll do with your life when you move. Do you see? What is the driver for my move? Now, there can be a taste issue, but do not let that be the dominant thing. If you're a follower of Jesus... you've got the example of God who left the paradise to go to the city. Why? For the sake of saving people, do you see? So for Christians to do the exact opposite without reference to that concern is to actually not have the mind of Christ, you see. So to drop out is the problem. But of course, wherever there are people, there are opportunities to go and do what God would have done and bring the news and message and serve and help, be publicly helpful, but not just drop out. But let me just say, it's the grey nomad thing. You know, to buy the caravan and spend the last 10 years of your life, 6 months touring around the country. Jake, what is driving that? The danger is it's middle class affluence and it's not Christ-likeness. Now, there's complexities here, but you hear what I'm trying to wrestle with? Yeah. That's helpful, though, to get some clarification. Yeah.
Andrew, isn't there a huge misconception with a lot of us a lot of people assume that what we need is what the undeveloped world has. And yet when we go to some parts of the world, these undeveloped nations, that they desire what the West have. And it's this tension in the middle where we've got Solomon declaring in chapter 1 that there's nothing new under the sun, that this is all part of human nature. And I think the simplicity of it all is concluded by is to please God.
Brother, preach the sermon. Yeah, let me just touch and I'll finish. I can see agitation. Let me finish by saying, wherever you look, there are problems. The developed world, the Western developed world, has rampant greed, has corruption, has generations destroyed, isolation, loneliness, bang. The undeveloped world has poverty, death, life expectancy, corruption, greed. Everywhere you go, why is that the case? Because humans are in both places. Humans live in all these spots. You cannot escape wherever you go. The only answer, and this is what I'm trying to say, when you think about these things and you come to the Bible, it gives this, God comes into the darkness of our mess and he says, I've got an answer. Listen to me. I'm not far from you. Come and find out. I'm recreating the world. And I'm going to remake it where everything will be made new. But nothing that's impure can be there, which means none of you make it. Except that in my love I gave my only son, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have eternal life. Oh, heed that message. How about I stop and pray? Our great God, we thank you for the fact that you are a God of love, holiness, righteousness, purity, goodness, love. And you have not left us in the dark, but you have come for us. And we confess that we are not what we ought to be and that we need your forgiveness and mercy. Please help us think. Please help us not let the simple pleasures of life drown out so many opportunities to be caused to stop, reflect and think, and help us pursue those opportunities. Think deeply, but do it with your word in hand, that we might grow to understand your word to us, a word of rescue. Amen.